This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Fears about politics, the economy, the environment, water shortages, the weather, dirty bombs, all-out nuclear war, and the final apocalypse and end of days have led some individuals and groups known as survivalists to prepare for ways to defend themselves. Survivalists are often considered pretty fringy, but now it's become a thing for some of the super rich. My guest Evan Osnos has written a new article in The New Yorker called Survival of the Richest about Silicon Valley executives, venture capitalists, and hedge fund managers who are stockpiling food, water, and ammunition and creating luxury escape havens. Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker and previously joined us to discuss his articles about white nationalists' support for the Trump campaign and executive orders President Trump could sign undoing existing agreements on climate change, immigration, and foreign policy. Evan Osnos, welcome back to Fresh Air. How did you find out about these super wealthy survivalists? How did you know this had become a thing?
Well, I came upon it sort of by chance. Actually, I was sitting on an airplane, and the person in the seat next to me, just coincidentally, was the CEO of a technology company in Silicon Valley. And this was a couple of years ago, and we got to talking, and I said, is there a story in Silicon Valley that people aren't writing about that you think is interesting? And he said, you should take a look at survivalism. And I didn't know exactly what he meant. And he said, you should look at survivalists in Silicon Valley. And he said, you won't find much about it publicly, but you may find something there. And, you know, I thought it was a kind of an oddball subject. But it also stayed with me because it seemed interesting, the idea that this place where people talk so much about the future and talk about the idea of changing the world, that there might be this other form of thinking and discussion in private about survival, was interesting. So I decided to start a project and began to start talking to people about it.
So what are Silicon Valley executives and former executives especially worried about regarding, you know, doomsday scenarios, the kind of thing that they have to prepare for by stocking up and building secret hideaways?
So some of the things that they talk about are the kind of stuff of ordinary disaster movies, the idea. But, you know, there is some real element to it. The idea, for instance, that there could be a pandemic if the Ebola virus, for instance, had affected a much larger part of the population, or an earthquake on the San Andreas in San Francisco. That's not a completely unreasonable fear, or the possibility of some sort of civil unrest. They take what they've seen in some American cities and extrapolate onto a larger scale, and they say, well, what would happen? But they pay less attention to what the initial event might be than what the aftermath would be, which is to say, as one person put it in this story, I worry about the temporary collapse of our government and its systems. What he means is that they feel a sense of fragility in our politics. Our politics have become disorderly. They've become hard to predict. And they look at it and they think, well, we're not entirely sure that our institutions are as sound as we've always assumed they are. And then there's another piece of it which is specific to technology, and that is a fairly prevalent fear in this community, which is that the growth and the development of artificial intelligence, which has become such a big subject of discussion, the idea that you will soon have a car that has no driver and eventually your goods will be delivered to a store by a truck that has no driver, that this kind of fundamental change in the American labor force will continue to produce tensions, particularly between people who are losing their jobs and people who are responsible for the technology that is bringing about that change. And so there is a quiet and constant conversation in Silicon Valley today about the idea that some of this extraordinary technology that's been created, like artificial intelligence, might in fact produce extraordinary social tension that they haven't yet figured out how to absorb.
So you're talking about a kind of literal class warfare.
Yeah, that's the way that they talk about it. I mean, Max Levchin, who was a co-founder of PayPal, is the CEO of a firm, a lending startup, who is opposed, actually, to this trend of survivalist thinking, but is surrounded by it. He said, you know, what people worry about is, to use Max's word, the pitchforks. And by that, he means the idea that the sort of tension that we saw with the Occupy movement a few years ago would take on a wider, more virulent form.
But it seems from your article that especially the Silicon Valley super wealthy know so much about the vulnerabilities within the electric grid and within the internet as a whole, that they're worried that those systems can be hacked, that there's flaws, that the internet can kind of be disrupted, the electric grid can be disrupted, the whole society can collapse as a result. How much is that the motivation for this new super wealthy survivalism?
Well, that's a big piece of it. If you're somebody who works in technology, then you got into that business in part because you tend to think about how systems fit together. And as one CEO of a multi-billion dollar technology company put it to me, he said, look, the truth is that our lives today are dependent on systems that are integrated, interdependent in ways that they simply weren't even 20 or 30 years ago. To give you an example, he said, the food that's on the shelves in our grocery stores depends on a supply chain that depends on GPS. And GPS, the global positioning system, depends to some degree on the internet. And the internet depends to some degree on another system known as DNS. And each one of these is vulnerable in its own ways. And so what he said, and this is, you know, he's a highly rational person who lives his life in very sophisticated ways in his business all the time. And he said, look, I'm not rushing out and declaring that the end of the world is near. But what I am saying is that it is, in his view, logically rational to talk about the fragility of these digital and electrical systems, which are really sort of second nature and largely unexamined as we go about our daily lives.
So are these new super wealthy survivalists kind of equally divided between liberals and conservatives, between the right and the left? Those people who have like political fears and fear that there's going to be a political breakdown that's going to lead to a rift in the social fabric of society.
Yeah, one of the surprises to me was that this was not something that was occupying one political wing or another. It seems to actually draw from both sides. Traditionally, most survivalists would describe themselves as libertarians somewhere out, typically on the conservative end of the spectrum. They put a high premium on self-reliance, on sort of distance from government. But there is a new element here, which is partly reflected in the success and the candidacy of Donald Trump. And that's the idea that there are, certainly in the case of Donald Trump, somebody who defies all of the conventional expectations and descriptions of politics, the sorts of experience required, the kind of standard to which he would be held for accuracy in what he says, all of the things that we used to assume would be absolutely fundamental about politics, those no longer obtain at the moment. And so to give you a literal example, Justin Kahn, who is a technology entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, who co-founded a company called Twitch, which was later sold to Amazon for $1 billion, he told me that after the election of Donald Trump, he got a call from a friend at a hedge fund who said to him, you know, if Donald Trump turns out to be, in Justin's words, a fascist dictator, well, the expected value of having an escape hatch, meaning having a home overseas, will be very high. So while it used to be a phenomenon that was principally associated, I think, on the far right end of the political spectrum, now you have people on the left who feel deeply uneasy about the direction that politics have taken.
So let's talk about some of the measures some of the super wealthy are taking to prepare for the doomsday scenarios that they fear. Tell us about one of the Silicon Valley executives that you spoke to.
Sure. I'll tell you about somebody named Steve Huffman, who is the CEO and a co-founder of Reddit, which is a very popular discussion site. It's valued at about $600 million. Steve graduated from the University of Virginia. He and his roommate ended up founding Reddit, which went on to become this very popular destination, one of the most popular sites on the internet. And Steve is concerned about what he describes as the sort of temporary loss of our government and institutions, to the point that he got eye surgery so that he's no longer nearsighted, because he believes that if you have contacts or glasses in the event of some sort of crack up of civilization, then that will make you likely to be a victim.
Because you'll lose your glasses and your contact lenses, so you'd better be able to just see.
Right. The theory is that if you're overly dependent on something like contact lenses, which let's say they're no longer being delivered to the store anymore, then that reduces your chances of survival. And he said, you know, he added, I also have a lot of food. He has a couple of motorcycles so that he could get out of town in a hurry. He has guns and he has ammunition. So he said, I think I could probably sort of hold up and protect myself for a while.
Let me ask you about another super wealthy Silicon Valley exec, and this is Antonio Garcia Martinez. What is he doing to prepare for the doomsday scenario he's envisioning?
Antonio Garcia Martinez, who worked at Facebook, later was an advisor to Twitter, in the midst of the presidential campaign when it was getting really toxic between supporters of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, he decided to buy 5 acres on an island in the Pacific Northwest, and he brought in generators and solar panels and, as he put it, thousands of rounds of ammunition. Because, as he says, when a society loses its founding myth, you know, the thing that holds it together, well, then it can descend into chaos. And well, that's his...
What's the founding myth he was referring to? Do you know?
Well, one of the things... Yeah, what he was referring to is something that you hear across these conversations. And that's the idea that we are ultimately held together by a kind of commitment to the United States as a functioning entity. It's a sort of consensus, a belief that our politics are possible, that it's worth participating, that it's, you know, that our institutions are sound, that the president, for instance, will abide by the Constitution, that the courts will have the say over the things which the Constitution allows them to govern. So what they feel, the survivalists in Silicon Valley and in finance circles in New York who are expressing this view, is that they are worried that there's been this kind of creeping disrespect for fairly basic institutions in American life, the things that people used to believe were sources of authority. So, for instance, today, you know, there is fake news, which is completely, you know, sort of obviously false and made up, intended to deceive people. But that term has already been misappropriated by people who are using it, including, it's worth saying clearly, including the President of the United States, to describe things that he doesn't agree with. And the idea and the concern is that if we're entering into a period in which some of the most traditional sources of authority in American life, including the intelligence community and a free press, are no longer considered sacred and trustworthy, well, then we're entering a really uncertain period in which it becomes hard to know, for instance, whether there will be, you know, talk about fake evidence or whether contracts will be honored. And so people whose livelihoods depend so much on the sanctity of these kinds of basic institutions are worried, and they're, in their words, hedging.
Yes, but the people that we're talking about, the super wealthy, they have enough money that they could really help support social institutions. They could help support any social change that they believe in. They could help support institutions whose funding is in jeopardy. They could do a lot to help bolster the society that they fear is going to crack up and fall apart.
Yeah, that is very much the argument among those who are opposed to this phenomenon. In Silicon Valley, for instance, Max Levchin, who is a sort of prominent investor and entrepreneur, says that this idea, this kind of survivalist thinking, is, as he puts it, one of the things that bothers him most about life in Silicon Valley today. He says, I often ask people when they say to me what they're going to do in the quote-unquote apocalypse, I say, well, how much have you donated to your local homeless shelter? How much have you actually really tried to address the underlying sources of social tension that are the cause of this anxiety? Because as he puts it, look, we're at a relatively benign point in the economy right now. And the concern would be, instead of talking about what you're going to do if, you know, some faintly sci-fi scenario emerges, why don't you talk about what you could do right now to actually invest in the American project to try to strengthen these institutions and to help people in need?
One of the most interesting enclaves that you write about in case society falls apart is this like super luxury condo that's actually in a former nuclear missile silo. Would you describe this?
Yeah, this is called the Survival Condo Project, and it is a couple of hours north of Wichita, Kansas, in an old missile silo complex that was built in 1961 at the height of the Cold War. And the missile silo was decommissioned in 1965, as a lot of them were around the country, and there was sort of no obvious use for them until a few years ago. It was developed by somebody named Larry Hall, who's a developer and a survivalist himself. And what he realized was that there was a certain kind of a buyer out there, a potential buyer who would be willing to spend, in this case, about $3 million for an apartment underground, or $1.5 million for half an apartment. And so he bought this silo and invested about $20 million into turning it into essentially a kind of luxury condo that's underground. And it can support 75 people on the food and the fuel that it has. And then it can, he says, operate indefinitely because it'll have hydroponic vegetables and it will grow its own fish in farms and also be able to generate power with renewable energy because it's got wind turbines and also uses geothermal energy.
So I was going to ask you if all of this is a big secret, but there's a website for this survival condo project. On the website, it says, this is the safety you need with the kind of comfort you'd come to expect from a luxury condo. And I thought, wow, that's what a sales pitch. I mean, I never expected there to be a website for this describing all the advantages of buying a condo in this former nuclear missile silo.
Yeah, I kind of scratched my head when I first heard about this, and I wasn't sure if it was real. So I went out to go see it, to go spend a night in this and sort of get a feel for it. And sure enough, it does exist. And Larry Hall has sold every unit in it except one for himself, he says. And it is true that if you go down and you go to these apartments, they look more or less like apartments that you would find at any sort of high-end apartment building. They just happen to be underground, and they don't have windows, and so what they've done is install video screens as windows so that you don't get claustrophobic. And the video screens show a scene that is a live feed of the sky and the surface above, or you can have it play whatever you want. At one point, they had a prospective customer who wanted to see the view from her window in New York City, and so the idea was to take footage of Central Park that she could see out her window and then have it projected from these kind of video windows underground.
It's a screensaver, basically.
It's essentially a screensaver, an apocalyptic screensaver.
Exactly. So how did it feel to spend the night there?
I mean, perhaps surprisingly, it was not as odd as you might expect. Once you're in there, you kind of forget at certain moments that you're underground. He relied on some of the interior decorating tricks that they use for cruise ships so that you can use a compact space very efficiently. There were a lot of lights, for instance, to keep it very bright so that it didn't feel gloomy. You know, and it has a library, and it has a movie theater, and it has a classroom and so on. But you know, you have to kind of remind yourself every once in a while that the only reason why a person would be in this facility is that something really dreadful has happened to the world above. And so you sort of remember every few minutes, well, let's hope that nobody is ever, ever required to be inside this thing.
So I don't know much about flying, but it seems to me if something's happened to, like, the internet system and GPSs aren't operating, which is one of the fears in the Silicon Valley, how are you going to be able to navigate your plane, your private plane, to get to this place?
Well, one of the scenarios that is, I think, pretty common that I heard about over and over again from sort of ultra wealthy survivalists is that they think that this doesn't generally happen overnight. You know, that sure, there are scenarios like a internet blackout, some sort of major technical collapse. But the real risk, the thing that they worry about, is more fundamental, and that's basically the erosion of social stability. They really do feel, on some level, they sense that there is, because of income inequality and the unaddressed feeling of haves and have-nots in this country, that there really is a source of tension that were something to happen, it wouldn't happen overnight, and it would happen gradually, and it would become, you know, there would come a point at which they would no longer feel safe being in the cities and being in the homes where they live. And that's the point at which they would go into these compounds, either in the U.S. or they would fly abroad.
So, you know, when the web started, and even when, like, the internet started in terms of being accessible to regular people and not just people in government, it seemed to be, or at least have the potential of becoming, a utopian community where things are free and accessible and people like chat online and form affinity groups and just, you know, a lovely, wonderful utopian idea. Stuart Brand, who created the Whole Earth Catalog, co-founded something called The Well, which was one of the first like online communities. And it was amazing. And now there's this like totally dark underside to the internet. You've got Silicon Valley executives preparing for, you know, the social apocalypse. So what happened to that utopian vision? Like the last people to have it now seem to be some of the people in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that is the most interesting question at the center of this. I mean, in some ways, Stuart Brand, who was this sage of Silicon Valley, really. I mean, he was one of Steve Jobs' great heroes. And the reason he was an icon was that he published a magazine called The Whole Earth Catalog, which was this kind of combination of techie thinking and hippie thinking. And his motto was, we are as gods and we better get good at it. What did he mean? He meant that the tools that we've created for ourselves, both as technologists and also sort of the literal tools on the farm, these are powerful things and they can make tremendous difference in our lives, but it's not altogether clear if it's going to be good or bad. And what we've discovered, I think, over the last several years, and certainly over the course of the last several months, where we've discovered that the internet became a kind of high-speed conveyor belt in some cases for absolutely fraudulent information, which, you know, what's now known as fake news, zipped around the country in ways that it never could have a generation ago. And people believed it. We now know that. The survey data is quite clear. And as a result, they believed things about political candidates that were not true. I had a fascinating conversation with Stuart Brand for this story about survivalism in Silicon Valley. And I called him up and I said, what do you make of this? He's been in that community for 40 years. And I said, what do you make of this? And he said, you know, I dabbled in survivalism, he said, in the 70s. He tried it for a little while, but he decided it was kind of strange, the idea that walking around believing that the world was about to end. And what he said is that over the years, he's become much more impressed by examples of resilience rather than examples of frailty. For example, in the last 10 years, the United States has weathered a recession, the largest recession since the Great Depression. It now has unemployment at low, manageable levels. There was an Ebola crisis, which was predicted to be much worse in the end than it ultimately was. It was certainly costly, but it was nowhere near what it could have been. And that was because people took it upon themselves to do something about it. And then another example would be Japan, that suffered this tsunami and a cascade of nuclear meltdowns. And from that, yet it has soldiered on. And so what Stuart Brand said is that the hardest problem that we face today is not the idea that the world is about to end, this idea which we circulate among ourselves, let's say online in these communities, but it actually is the much more mundane but more likely scenario, which is that we chug on, that we continue, and we are faced with these practical problems, social problems about how do we help the neediest members of our society and how do we make sure that people are taken care of who need it.
Well, Evan Osnos, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Terry.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new article is called Survival of the Richest. Ayelet Waldman has had a wide-ranging and often controversial career as a writer, ranging from her early Mommy Track mystery series to literary novels to her notorious essay collection, Bad Mother. Her latest book is a memoir called A Really Good Day. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Ayelet Waldman is a real handful. As people would have said once upon a time in my old New York neighborhood, she's got a mouth on her. 2 years ago, when her novel Love and Treasure was left off the list of the New York Times 100 Notable Books of the Year, Waldman F-bombed the Times on social media. But that incident was a mere ripple compared to the controversy Waldman sparked 12 years ago with that essay. You know, the one in the Modern Love column of The Times, in which she confessed to loving her husband, the novelist Michael Chabon, more than her 4 then small children. That essay has defined Waldman ever since as a loose cannon. And that reputation is sure to be reinforced by her nervy, funny, and thought-provoking new book, A Really Good Day. A Really Good Day is Waldman's first-person account of her month-long adventure microdosing LSD. In her preface, Waldman tells readers that she was diagnosed years ago with a variant of bipolar disorder. For as long as I can remember, she says, I have been held hostage by the vagaries of mood. When my mood is good, I am cheerful, productive, and affectionate. I sparkle at parties. I write decent sentences. I have what the kids call swag. When my mood swings, however, I am beset by self-loathing and knotted with guilt and shame. Waldman is not one to suffer those low moods in silence. She picks fights, shouts, and slams doors. She confesses that the sound of her husband chewing almonds, even two rooms away in their house, is enough to send her into a blinding rage. Waldman lives in Berkeley, so there's nothing she hasn't tried in terms of mindfulness, meditation, and yoga, along with the services of psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. The list of psychotropic meds she's been prescribed and found wanting takes up almost a page-long paragraph of this memoir. So it is that in an effort to be less of a difficult woman to herself and her family, Waldman becomes intrigued by the work of James Fadiman, a psychologist and researcher who's chronicled the effects of microdosing LSD. In other words, taking the drug in doses so low that it doesn't cause trippy hallucinations. Despite the fact that Waldman says she's so not a free spirit, and despite the fact that she was once a public defender and law professor with a substantive knowledge of U.S. drug laws, she decides to give microdosing a try. Waldman discreetly puts out the word that she's looking for a source. Through a friend of a friend, she makes contact with a man who calls himself Lewis Carroll, and he sends Waldman a package containing a blue dropper bottle allegedly full of LSD. After squinting through her middle-aged reading glasses to make out the directions on the LSD testing kit she's ordered on Amazon, Waldman takes a leap of faith, swallows two drops from the mystery bottle, and jumps down the rabbit hole, which turns out to be a pretty mellow place. Waldman structures a really good day as a wide-ranging diary of her microdosing month, during which she reports that her mood levels out, she gets an enormous amount of writing done, her frozen shoulder improves, and she's so uncharacteristically chill that one of her kids finally asks, "Who are you?" Waldman has some sleep disruption, but nothing comes close to the bad side effects she's experienced on the prescription medication she's taken. At this point, I hasten to add, do not try this at home. LSD, of course, is still illegal. After a scary episode in which she tries to obtain a fresh supply of LSD from someone other than Lewis Carroll, even Waldman acknowledges that it's smarter and safer for her to quit trying to refill her blue dropper bottle. A really good day tells a really good story, one that will make readers think about how drugs get classified and how chemistry alters what we think of as essential personality traits. It's a story that only a woman who's lived most of her life being a handful would be gutsy enough to tell.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Really Good Day by Ayelet Waldman. My next guest, Kenneth Lonergan, wrote and directed the film Manchester by the Sea. It's nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. It's a moody film starring Casey Affleck as Lee Chandler, a man living in a neighborhood near Boston who seems to have cut himself off from life, except for doing his job as the maintenance man in a small complex of apartments, and getting drunk in bars and getting into fights. Early in the film, he learns his older brother, Joe, has died of congestive heart failure. Joe was separated from his wife years ago, and no one knows where she is. Lee returns to his hometown, Manchester by the Sea, to take care of funeral arrangements. In this scene, he's in the office of his brother's lawyer, where he learns he's been named the guardian of his brother's teenage son.
I don't understand.
Which part are you having trouble with?
Well, I can't be his guardian.
Well,
I mean, I can't.
Well, naturally, I assumed Joe had discussed all this with you.
No. He didn't. No.
I sorry, I have to say I'm somewhat taken aback.
He can't live with me. I live in one room.
Well, but Joe has provided for Patrick's upkeep. Food, clothes, etc. And the house and the boat are owned outright.
I can't commute from Boston every day until he turns 18.
I think the idea was that you would relocate.
Relocate to where?
Well, if you look, as you can see, you know, your brother worked everything out extremely carefully.
He can't have meant that.
There's a lot about Manchester by the Sea that I don't want to tell you because I want you to be able to see it and allow the story to unfold at its own pace. Kenneth Lonergan also wrote and directed the films Margaret and You Can Count on Me. His plays include The Waverly Gallery, The Starry Messenger, and This Is Our Youth, which was revived on Broadway 2 years ago. Kenneth Lonergan, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this film. Thank you for making it. So there's an opening montage in the film of the Casey Affleck character working as a janitor, and we see several scenes with several different tenants whose homes he's working in. He's repairing a toilet that isn't flushing right. He's plunging a stuffed-up toilet that's really messed up, and the tenant is really embarrassed by the whole thing. He's repairing a leaky shower with a woman who was really like rude and trying to seduce him at the same time. He's repairing a light fixture from an older woman who's on the phone complaining about mitzvah she has to go to. Each tenant has a different personality, impatient, grateful, nasty. And in that scene, we see the different shades of Lee's personality, his ability to be understanding and helpful, but also to push back hard. So what was your thinking behind that scene? Because it seems to do a lot of work in telling us what his life is like and who he is.
Well, that's essentially the what I wanted it to do. The idea of the opening was to present his daily life as it exists at the start of the film. And it's a pretty routinized life. He's very methodical. He's a very good custodian. He's also not interested in having much of a personal relationship with anybody. And the four scenes are four different kinds of interactions. And my idea was to somewhat coldly show him going through his day, which is a series of functions, activities, and tasks combined with an active effort to keep other human beings at bay. But someone pointed out to me recently that he didn't choose a job which keeps him totally isolated from people. He actually chose a job which puts him into contact with other human beings. So it's a very limited contact, but he's not quite as isolated as even I thought he was at the beginning writing the script.
I want to play another scene from the film. And in this scene, Casey Affleck and his nephew have just left the lawyer's office. And again, you know, Casey Affleck has been appointed the guardian of his nephew, but doesn't want to be the guardian. And so as they leave the office, they're arguing about what to do with the father's fishing boat. The late father was a commercial fisherman. And as they're arguing, a stranger walks by and mutters something sarcastic. And you play that stranger. So let's listen with that in mind. And playing the role of the nephew, Patrick, is Lucas Hedges.
Right, we've got a lot to do.
What about the boat?
We'll talk to George about it. There's no use hanging on to it. No one's going to use it.
I'm going to use it.
It's got to be maintained, Rich.
I'm going to maintain it.
Show it to me. You can't maintain it by yourself.
Why not? It's my boat now,
isn't
it?
You're a minor. You can't take it out alone. I'm the trustee.
What does trustee mean?
I got to keep up the inspections. It means I'm in charge of handling everything for you.
Does that mean you're allowed to sell the boat if I don't want you to?
I don't know. I'll definitely consider it.
No way.
So goddamn sure of yourself. There's no one to run it. You're 16 years old.
I get my license this year.
Doesn't matter. You're still a minor. You can't run a commercial vessel by yourself. Meanwhile, it's a big expense, and I'm the one that's going to manage it, and I'm not going to be here.
Who gives a f*** where you are?
Patty, I swear to God, I'm going to knock your block off.
Great parenting.
What? What'd you say?
I said great parenting.
Mind your business.
Good parenting in the face.
Hey,
smash me in the face.
Hey, it's okay. It's okay.
You want to
smash
me in the face. You want to smash your face?
Okay, that's the bleeped version of the scene. And that was Kenneth Lonergan as the stranger who walks by and says, great parenting. You've written several roles for troubled teens in your work, certainly in Margaret, which starred Anna Paquin in the troubled teen role.
Mm-hmm.
And in your new film, Manchester by the Sea, Patrick, the nephew, who's 16 years old, you know, he's mourning the loss of his father. His mother, like no one knows where his mother is, because his parents separated years ago.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's willing to acknowledge the pain that he's in. And so he's very abrasive and very sarcastic and cynical. And, you know, these characters are also in a period where they're having trouble with the adults in their lives.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you wrote This Is Our Youth, which is about people in their late teens and early 20s. But when you're writing the roles of teenagers, do you draw on your memories of your own teenage years or on teenagers who you know now?
I think more of the memories of my own teenage years, because the teenagers I know now don't really talk to me. My daughter talks to me. She's 14. And some of her friends talk to me, but I mostly watch them talking to each other. They're not... some of her friends are extremely pleasant and nice to us and talk to us all the time, and some of them just say, hello, you know, if you make them say hello. So I'm just very interested in teenagers, and I always have been. I remember those years very vividly, and it's always interesting to listen to them talking to each other on the street or walking past a school or anything like that. I just find it to be a very dramatic time of life, for lack of a better word. And I remember what it felt like to be a teenager, and I also remember observing my friends and schoolmates at the time in a kind of a funny way, because I was one of them, but I was also watching and noticing this sort of extreme behavior combined with this I don't know, really beautiful extra passion for everything that teenagers seem to have. And I find the combination to be endlessly fascinating.
So you said you remember what it felt like to be a teenager. What did it feel like to you? What are some of those?
Not great. I think, well, but that's actually not true. I remember this intense fascination for things that was really at the ready. The same time, I didn't feel too good socially. I had a small group of close friends that got smaller and smaller as I got older, and I think that part wasn't so great. I didn't have a girlfriend in high school. That was a constant problem, and I didn't know what you were supposed to do, you know, in situation with the opposite camp, and there was all sorts of difficulties in that regard. But there's something about the fecundity of a mind that age that I really think is that I remember very well, and wish I could carry a bit more of that with me as I get older.
So I want to play another scene from the film, and this is a scene in which Patrick, the nephew, has band practice, and he doesn't have a driver's license, so Lee, the uncle, the Casey Affleck character, has to drive him around all over. So the nephew has two girlfriends, and Lee's taking him over to his other girlfriend's house, where he has band practice. She's in the band. She's the singer in the band.
This is the same girl that was over at the house?
No, that was Sylvie, and this is Sandy. And they don't know about each other, so please don't say anything in case it comes up.
I won't. Do you actually have sex with these girls?
Well, we don't just play computer games.
With both of them?
Well, with Sandy's mom here, it's sort of, strictly just like basement business.
What does that mean?
It means I'm working on it.
He's so annoying in that scene.
I don't think so. I was just thinking how nice he was.
Patrick, the nephew?
Yeah, because he starts out with this kind of stupid bragging, and then he gets asked a couple of questions, and he gives a pretty straight answer, which I think is, I don't know, I kind of like him for it.
What does basement business mean? Is that your phrase? I've never heard it before. You made that up?
It means they're stuck in the basement and the mom could knock on the door at any moment, so there's not too much they can do. But I invented that myself.
But they're actually upstairs in her bedroom.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you don't always get to shoot in the room you thought you were going to shoot. And anyway, basement business is alliterative and upstairs room business is not.
Right. You use music so beautifully in your films, and in Manchester by the Sea, there's one scene in particular which I'm not going to describe because I want our listeners to be able to see the film for themselves and not have it all kind of told to them beforehand. But I'll just say it's a very, very emotional, life-changing scene, and it kind of this scene is actually made up of several smaller scenes, but it's all held together by one piece of music that runs underneath the whole thing and sustains it. And it's an adagio by Tommaso Albinoni. And I just want to play a little bit of this because I don't want to give away too much of the story and why the story is so sad, but I think this music can help convey some of the emotion that you convey in the film. So here's the beginning of that piece. Philharmonic Orchestra, and that music is used in the soundtrack for Manchester by the Sea. That is so moving, that music, and the bass line is like a heartbeat, almost like a heartbeat with a little bit of arrhythmia. And so tell me what this music means to you and why you chose it for the emotional focal point of the movie.
Well, I think you put it very well. It's incredibly moving. It's got this great sorrow to it. It's also got a certain size to it. There's a feeling of inevitability to it, and it's just these cascading chords coming down in this terribly tragic and inevitable way. It's also very human, and I don't know. It does so much, this music.
So one more question. I've seen Manchester by the Sea twice. I saw it once at a screening before interviewing Casey Affleck, and there were three people in the theater then. Me, one of our producers, and somebody representing the movie. And we were just all sitting there in just silence, you know, just watching this movie, watching it play out. Then I saw it again with a large audience. And, you know, there's a lot of sarcasm in the film because, like, the nephew's really sarcastic and the Casey Affleck character has a pretty cutting wit. But yet they don't strike me exactly as, like, laugh lines because there's so much pain and so much anger, like, underlying all of the sarcasm. But the audience really actually laughed a lot during the film.
Well, I'm glad. I think it's
Are you
funny.
Glad? Tell me why you're glad.
Well, I think the movie's really funny. I mean, I think the characters have a good sense of humor, and I have a good sense of humor, and I think that the movie has a good sense of humor, and as it should. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, too. I'm sure I've said it before, but I feel like humor and drama are not just different sides of the same coin. They're the same thing. The really funny comedies, to me, are always the ones that are played the straightest or given the most emotional content. And when people start making faces and sending things up and commenting and winking at you, I don't find that to be very funny. Really good comedy, I think, is played as if it was real, and it's the circumstances that make it amusing. And I think that the inverse or the reverse is true for drama. I don't think there's a lot of life in anything that's humorless. There are some situations in life that are simply not funny, and there's nothing funny about them, but they're rare, and they don't last all that long. As soon as you get somewhere else, something else is happening that is probably somewhat amusing in some way. So to me, without humor, the movie would be an arid dirge, and I don't want that, and I don't want the film to be a punishing experience for people, and it's not even so much a question of providing comic relief as providing that side of life in the movie so that the movie resembles life and not just one narrow piece of it. There are a couple of laughs that I don't actually like or share, but you get used to that when you're a playwright or a filmmaker. You get used to the audience not always thinking the same thing as funny as what you do.
Give me an example.
Well, there's a line he has when Patrick is very, very upset because he finally has a breakdown. They can't bury the father right away because the ground is too hard and the cemetery he's going to be buried in doesn't allow the use of heavy equipment. So they have to wait to spring to bury the father. And the image of his father being frozen in the interim is very disturbing to Patrick. And he's been pretty stoical about the whole thing until he knocks some frozen chicken from the freezer onto the floor and he has a panic attack. And Lucas does the scene beautifully. He has this real breakdown and he's sobbing and he's just terrified and upset by the sight of this frozen food because it's reminding him of his father being a body and not a person. Then he runs up to his room, he locks himself in, and Casey's character insists on him opening the door. And then he kicks the door open when the kid refuses to open the door. And he says to him, I just don't like him being in the freezer. And Casey says, I understand that. You've expressed that very clearly. I don't like it either. There's nothing we can do about it. And if you're going to freak out every time you see a frozen chicken, I think we should take you to the hospital. I don't know anything about this. Now, that line always gets a big laugh. And I think it's because the word chicken is a funny word. I don't actually find it to be particularly amusing. I think he's really trying to help out, and he doesn't know what to do, and he doesn't know what to say. And he's trying to point out to the kid that he's very upset and possibly to the point where maybe they should go see a doctor or something. But it always gets a laugh. But it doesn't bother me at all, really, in the end, because I think people are involved in the scene, and if there's something that suddenly comes out of left field as an odd phrase or a funny-sounding word, I just don't think it hurts the scene terribly. And that's the idea, anyway, to get them involved.
Kenneth Lonergan, thank you so much for your movies, and thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's such a pleasure.
Kenneth Lonergan wrote and directed the film Manchester by the Sea. It's nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer for this edition is Kevin Griffin. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.